Good evening. It is Tuesday evening, June 29th. As Rabbi Feldman is here, tonight's year is sponsored by the Shand family to commemorate the yard site of Michael's father, Shmuel Yitzchak Ben Shlomo.
Thank you very much. Tonight is part two. I'm not sure if everyone here was here for part one. Just to quickly orient ourselves. That it's two separate parts, but just to quickly orient ourselves as to what we were talking about then and what we were talking about tonight. The topic of organ transplants, organ donations, which is the topic of both parts, is a highly, highly controversial, difficult topic, a topic of tremendous sensitivity and tremendous difficulty on both ends. And as we emphasized very strongly last time, it's not our position here to take a stand on this issue. It's not at all my role, what I'm trying to do. Our goal is just to give a little bit of an overview of what some of the issues are, what some of the perspectives are, what are some of the key concerns on both sides of the equation. And tonight is the much more controversial part. The two parts of the discussion are essentially donations from living donors, which involve a number of issues that we spoke about last week or 2 weeks ago, rather. The question of to what extent is one permitted and or required to donate to someone else when it involves a risk to their own person, if it doesn't involve risk to their own person, if it involves giving up a limb, all these different considerations and how we balance the different goals, both of saving a life, which we certainly acknowledge as a major imperative, as a major mitzvah in all senses of the word. We talked a little bit then about the mitzvah of healing, of imperative to provide that service when possible, some of the different philosophical issues, why it is the Talmud tells us that there is permission given to the doctor to heal. One would think that it's a mitzvah clearly, so then why do I need to be told that it's permitted? And it touches upon issues that are both legal and philosophical. Philosophical in the sense that maybe one would say it's not my job to interfere. If God made somebody sick, maybe I don't have the right to get in the way. The same way one could say I don't have the right to interfere with somebody's poverty. If God made him poor, I shouldn't have to give him tzedakah. So the Talmud already tells us that's not the attitude that we take. So some of the Rishonim understand that that's why the Talmud tells us that there's permission for the doctor to heal, but that's not the attitude, that we don't say it's not right to get involved if God made somebody sick. And there's also a legal perspective that maybe I might think if I'm going to perform surgery on somebody, for example, so there's a chance I could do more harm than good. I have to first cut the person up before healing the person, and that could incur all kinds of problems, and therefore maybe that's not a legitimate action to take. So that's how other Rishonim understood this. Why Talmud tells us that when a qualified professional is doing this, so then that it's permitted, it's not considered to be unjustified assault, which would incur all kinds of liabilities. So that was some of the issues behind the mandate to heal, the mitzvah to heal, and then working from that to the concepts that are relevant towards healing, not necessarily as a doctor, but as a donor, when you're in a position to give a part of yourself to somebody else. So what does that put upon you in terms of responsibility? What does it put in terms of, what does that put upon you in terms of permissibility if you're taking upon a certain risk upon yourself, and all the actions and all the issues that are related to that? That was essentially the subject matter of our last discussion. And it brings us to part two, again, even more complicated and controversial issue, and that has to do with the donating of organs from deceased individuals, from people who are no longer alive, taking their organs and giving them to somebody else. So that's a topic that has a lot of complicated controversy associated with it. One thing I want to say right off the bat, that very often if you read about this topic in the newspapers, you read about this in the press, in the Jewish newspapers, in the secular newspapers, it's usually presented in a way that's not very accurate. It's usually presented in a way that's overly simplistic on both sides of the equation. And it says that there are Orthodox Jews who are opposed to organ transplants because they're concerned about the resurrection of the dead, things like that. And that's not really an issue. I don't think in all of the extensive literature about this, you won't find this even alluded to anywhere. The issues are much more than that, and there are very serious issues on both sides of the equation. One of the issues, which is less of a hurdle to get over, but is a real issue, but is more easily dealt with, and we'll mention it first, is that strictly speaking, there is a prohibition to derive benefits from a dead body as an issue of Hanam and Hamesh, and related, possibly the same, possibly an additional prohibition, There's also a prohibition to cut up a dead body. We call, on the one hand, handal and hamesh, benefiting from the dead body. And in addition to that, nivul hamesh, which would mean desecrating a dead body or cutting up a dead body. So these are both, strictly speaking, prohibited. So on the surface, that would be a problem. That would be an issue in terms of taking an organ. However, and we'll discuss this in a little more detail, it's generally agreed that these two prohibitions are both suspended when it's for the purposes of pikuach nefesh. So if it's going to save somebody else's life, so saving a life generally overrides almost all of the Torah, with a few exceptions. So if it's going to save somebody's life, so normally we're allowed to be machal shabbos, we're allowed to eat non-kosher food, we're allowed to do all kinds of things. So the prohibition of hanam and hamesh and nivul hamesh, both of these prohibitions, seem to be on the surface straight prohibitions that are similar to all the rest of the Torah. So therefore, they should be overridden by pikuach nefesh considerations. Probably. It's pretty much consensus that that's true. But there's at least two points we should be aware of. One is that it's not 100% consensus. There was a view among the Achronim that didn't agree. That was the Binyan Sheehan. The Binyan Sheehan was the Yaakov Ettlinger, who was the Rebbe of Samson of Falhurst, the author of many important Svarim, and he understood this concept a little bit differently. It's a little bit of a question as to what exactly is the prohibition of benefiting from the dead body. What is this prohibition about? What's the concept behind it? So many understood that it has to do with the mitzvah of Kvura, that we have a mitzvah to bury a dead body and a mitzvah to bury all of the dead bodies. So if we're going to take away any part of it, so that's going to negate the mitzvah of burial, which may also give some parameters to the prohibition of benefiting. It could be that benefiting that doesn't interfere with burial might be permitted. That's the way some of the Achronim understood. So, for example, for a medical student to look at a dead body, doesn't have to take away any part of it, doesn't have to cut it up in any way. So there were those who thought that was not an issue in terms of hanam and hamesh. So hanam would only mean the type of hanam, the type of benefit that would interfere with it being buried. That's how some understood. But the Binyan Sheehan understood that it has to do with the concept of theft, that there is a sense of ownership that the individual has of his body even after he passes away, which is a chiddush, which is not the kind of idea that we necessarily would have assumed to be the case. It's part of why it's a minority view. And therefore, we don't have the right to take away this person's body for our purposes. It's a type of gzela. So you might say, okay, even if I accept that definition, even if I believe that it's gzela, so we believe that everything is yeharvay, everything is pikuach nefesh al chasachal. So I'm allowed to steal to save my life also. So that is the way we assume, but there was an opinion in the Talmud not that way. There is an opinion in the Talmud that seems to say that when I say that I'm allowed to violate the Torah in order to save my life, that's if it's between me and God. So God tells me to keep Shabbos. God tells me to eat kosher food. So he'll understand if I have to break the law in order to save my life. But who says that the owner of the property is going to allow me to take his stuff in order to save my life? Maybe I have to get his permission first. And that's the famous Heinz dilemma about somebody who wants to steal medicine in order to save his wife's life. So it's a little bit of an issue. Do we assume that when you get somebody else involved, that necessarily true, you're allowed to infringe on their rights to save somebody's life? So practical halacha, we normally assume yes. But there was some discussion about it. There is some, Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he says he doesn't think it's a question at all, but there is what to discuss, that there were those who felt that if you have to violate somebody else's rights in order to save your life, maybe you don't have the right to do that. So the Binyan Sheehan was the lone voice who had this opinion, that there is a issue of gzela, A, and B, that even in a life-threatening situation, that's not going to allow you to override that. Again, this is not a majority view. It's not really a view that really won in the day. In the last century, there was another posek who held this view. There was a prominent posek from Tel Aviv whose name was Yeshua Ehrenberg, who wrote the Silas and Shuvah's Dvar Yehoshua. So he also took this view, that he also thought that, he says, I know the whole world is against me, but I have to say what I think, and he thinks that this was the case. But again, the majority view was that pikuach nefesh would indeed override the prohibition of nivul hamesh and hanam and hamesh. But even once you take that position, so there still are some questions to figure out. So first of all, what's considered to be pikuach nefesh? What are the parameters of pikuach nefesh as far as this is concerned? This was a topic that was really first taken up by the Noda de Behuda. The Noda de Behuda is Chazko Landau, the Rav of Prague, was writing about 250 years ago. So he was confronted with the question of autopsies. Somebody had died of a disease and they wanted to look at his body to try to figure out what it was that caused this disease. So he contributed this question: to what extent do you consider a pikuach nefesh in order to cut up a body, not for the use of the body, but for a knowledge that will come from that to be applied to somebody else? So he set a guideline over there, which many of the later poskim accepted, although it was somewhat of a question, that in order to justify the offense towards this person, to save somebody else's life, so it couldn't be abstract. It couldn't just be, well, maybe someday this will help somebody, but it has to be very direct. And he had the standard that it has to be a situation, what he called a cholol lefanenu, and this was an expression that was borrowed from much of the later literature in this context and many other contexts as well, that there has to be a sick person in front of you who will directly benefit from this investigation, that if what you're going to do is going to help somebody right now, so then that could justify overriding this prohibition. But if it's not that case, if it's far removed, so then he felt that that was not going to justify nivul hamesh, so that's not going to rise to the level of pikuach nefesh. And apparently, because if that were the case, otherwise the parameters would be too loose and the prohibition would basically fall away. So many of the later postmen accepted this definition, but they expanded it tremendously. Once you got to a situation where you have a global village, where you have greater access and greater technology, greater connections to the rest of the world, so a whole of Faneno didn't have to necessarily mean physically in front of you in this town or in this city or anywhere near here, but you could reach somebody far away, so that would expand the parameters, and that was the position taken in the middle of the 20th century by Chaim Moshe Kaczynski, one of the greatest postmen of 100 years ago, 60 years ago, in Vilna. And later on, the Israeli chief rabbinic in the times of war took the position also that even in terms of skin, needed for burn patients, that even for purposes of a bank, when you have a situation where it's likely that there's going to be a need in the near future, even if it's not anywhere right now, but we already know that it comes up often enough, that the definition of chol lefanenu would be expanded, not just in terms of place, but in terms of time as well, to greater parameters. There is some question as to whether or not this whole limitation of chol lefanenu should really be accepted. There was a prominent rav in Eretz Yisrael, his name was Nelson Friedman, who authored the Shalos and Shuvas Mitzvah Matai. So he has a tshuva which really goes in both directions, but initially he questions the Noda Behuda's whole limitation, because the Noda Behuda there has a comparison to Chil Shabbos, or override Shabbos in order to save a life. But there we assume that it has to directly save a life, not potentially save a life in the future, because otherwise we'll always be Machal Shabbos in order to justify every potential situation that might come up. So as the Nature Matai points out, it's not really comparable, because if I have some kind of a far off in the future need, so fine, so I won't be Machal Shabbos, I'll take care of it tomorrow. I have 6 other days in a week in which this can be attended to. But here we're talking about a prohibition that applies all the time. So if we're not going to override this for a more long-term need, then we're never going to override it, and we're never going to be able to figure out what's going on. So therefore, it's not really comparable to the situation of justifying Chol Shabbos, which allows for another opportunity. So therefore, he took some issue with Noda Behuda's limitation, although in the end he comes down and questioning that maybe we do have to value the Kavod Hamesh component a little more than we do. We can't let that part be totally forgotten. So it comes down a little bit on both parts of the equation, as we find in many of the issues here. But this question of whether it has to be so immediate is a little bit questionable. I saw recently quoted in the name of Rabbi Soloveitchik, that Rabbi Soloveitchik said that if a doctor told him that an autopsy was necessary for medical knowledge, so he would talk to him and he would ask him, tell me exactly how it's going to benefit humanity, tell me exactly how people will be served by this autopsy, and if he, I don't know exactly what criteria to use, but if he felt that it was strong enough potential that it was going to make a difference, then he would allow it. And I was discussing this issue recently with the Rabbi Shachter. He also indicated that he wasn't sure why the Noda Behuda took this position, because normally pikuach nefesh does not require that it has to be immediate, that even potential future pikuach nefesh is usually a significant factor as well. And I mentioned, I think, in the name of the Chazon Ish, that perhaps the Noda Behuda was concerned that if the parameters here are too loose, so then the prohibition is going to be completely negated, it's going to be completely taken away, and that itself is called a chil Hashem. If you have a prohibition completely nullified, and not just under some circumstances, but completely. So then maybe that's what the Noda Yehuda was concerned about. But one could question that as well, because even if you have very broad parameters of Pikuach Nefesh, there still are going to be situations which are clearly not Pikuach Nefesh. If one wants to take from a dead body for the purposes of jewelry or something like that, so that will clearly be prohibited according to everybody. So it's not like the prohibition itself would be negated. It's only in situations where it's relevant for Pikuach Nefesh. So there's a little bit to figure out about why exactly this limitation is there and what exactly it represents and whether or not it's 100% accepted. But that's one of the issues. One of the issues is that even once we accept that Pikuach Nefesh will override these prohibitions, so we have to figure out if it's the situation that we're dealing with. Is it an immediate Pikuach Nefesh, or is it a more far-off Pikuach Nefesh? What exactly is on the table? So then that's also a question. So there are surgeries which are not Pikuach Nefesh. So, for example, what about a cornea transplant? That was a major issue of post-development. That this is a surgery that also potentially could be taken from a dead body, and it could have a tremendous benefit. It could restore somebody's vision, but it's not necessarily called Pikuach Nefesh. It's not necessarily called restoring their life. So do we assume that that overrides this prohibition? So that's an interesting question. So Rav Unterman, who was the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, one of the first chief rabbis, so he had a tshuva shaved in the Yehuda. He took the stance that this was permitted. He had a number of reasons why it's permitted. So one reason why he said it was permitted is because, first of all, he's not sure that this is called nivul hamesh. That taking a cornea from a dead body might not necessarily be called nivul hamesh. Why not? So there are two ways to say that. Either because maybe this is considered like skin, and skin might not necessarily fall into the same category. That's a debate that some of the folks can have. But also, the body essentially would be intact. You wouldn't be able to perceive the difference if you remove the cornea. The eyes are closed anyway, so maybe that's not a problem of nivul hamesh. That was one possible logic that he advanced. Another position that he took, which is an interesting area for discussion, is there is a comment the Gemara has in the Sefer Avodah Zarah, and Daf Chaf Zayin, where the Gemara seems to say that a wound to an eye, something that will take out an eye, is life-threatening. Seems to call an injury to the eye a situation of Pikuach Nefesh. Which is a fascinating question, because this is a big issue which later posts can talk about this, which Eliezer has tshuvas about this, others have tshuvas about this, that here, let's say you have a situation where now we could be more lenient based on medical situations, and maybe nowadays a doctor will tell me, I can tell you right now, it's not Pikuach Nefesh, but the Gemara seems to call it Pikuach Nefesh, so should we be more machner like the Gemara? Should we say we'll go against, you know, even though we would certainly use up-to-date medical knowledge Lakula, so to speak, that we would say that even if the Gemara thinks it's not Pikuach Nefesh, if a doctor tells me today that something is Pikuach Nefesh, so we would use the most current medical knowledge, we'd assume that it is. But here, it could go in reverse. If the Gemara says Pikuach Nefesh and the doctor might tell you it's not, so do you override what the doctor says and call it Pikuach Nefesh anyway? Right. No, not necessarily. And there's a little bit of a debate whether, if we assume that it's connected to the mitzvah of burial, which is how some understood, so then there is a question whether there's the same obligation of burial as far as Jewish dead bodies and non-Jewish dead bodies. But everyone agrees there's a basic imperative to treat the deceased with dignity. The question is, does it have the same parameters as that parameter of requiring burial or not? So there's a little bit of room to argue. It's a little bit of an open question. So one could find room to distinguish, but not necessarily. Hi. Oh, so did I mention that? So that was the flip side of the Binyan Sin, by the way. The Binyan Sin, I don't know if I mentioned it, they said that even though he had this chumrah that is, thought it was theft, so the flip side was that he also felt he could give permission. And since it was all based on an issue of stealing, that if the person in his lifetime said he should allow it, so then he would allow it. So if you believe, if you're working off that view, working off the Binyan Sin's normally stringent position, so then permission makes a difference. If it's all about kvura, though, then permission makes a little less of a difference, because the same way we don't allow a person to say he's going to be cremated because it's not up to him through the midst of kvura, so that wouldn't help so much. So it's also going to depend a little bit what exactly is the basis of the concern. So this was the second piece that the Shevet Mihuda that Rav Unterman mentioned, that maybe we should take seriously this expression in the Gemara that a injury to the eye is considered like Pikuach Nefesh, and even if the doctors nowadays will tell us that's not true, maybe we have the right still to treat it like Pikuach Nefesh based on this expression in the Gemara. And the third position he has, which really could apply to all organs, and it's interesting view, which you find in a few other svarim as well, is that maybe once the organ is placed into a living body, so now it becomes alive again. And now it's considered to be not benefiting from the dead body, now it's considered to be alive. There were a couple of different versions of that perspective. There were those who felt they shouldn't make a difference at all, they didn't buy that whole approach. And others felt that, well, if the issue again is burial, so then maybe this will eventually be buried. It'll be buried the next time. It'll be buried when the recipient dies. So it's not a bitul kvur. It's not taking it away from its kvur. It's just delaying it. And until it's buried, it's going to be now revitalized. And maybe that helps. So that was a little bit of the debate. The Sridi Eish and others, the Sridi Eish has a tshuva where he takes issue with every one of these points. He doesn't think that any of this is compelling. He doesn't think that this idea of revitalizing an organ by putting in is going to make much of a difference. He doesn't think that we could be nakal just because it's considered to be like skin. He doesn't buy that. And also, it says when the Gemara says it, it's pikuach nefesh, so the Gemara is saying that if a person is facing an injury which is on the surface going to just affect his eye, then we have to worry that maybe it's actually going to affect his whole ability to live. But if a person has been blind his whole life and has been alive the past 50 years being blind, so then we don't have necessarily a reason to assume that his continuing to be blind is a situation of pikuach nefesh. Although other poskim weren't so sure. If Pesach Frank has a tshuva in which he says that there is certainly an extra element of danger a person lives with when he can't see, and even if he's managed to survive all this time, still he'll, he lives at a higher level of risk. And therefore, maybe that alone, a person who is unable to see is going to be have a higher life expectancy if he can see. He's going to have a less of a danger level. So maybe that's also somehow included within the rubric of pikuach nefesh. All of those positions would assume that we're talking about a person who's completely blind. If a person is only blind in one eye, and if the question is being able to go from one eye to two, so then the equation might be very different. So that's another issue that comes up. So essentially, this is, so to speak, the easier part of the harder part, that is the second more controversial section. So that was the less controversial part, the question of dealing with these prohibitions of Hanam and Hamesh and Nivul Hamesh. So we just looked at the basic issue of whether Pikuach Nefesh overrides that. Majority view that it does. Some question as to what exactly is considered to be Pikuach Nefesh in terms of how immediate does the benefit have to be, and also in terms of whether the benefit itself is considered always to be life-saving. All of that somewhat of a discussion. But the thornier issue, and again here we are really just here to sketch out the basic outline of the issue, is that even though we assume that Pikuach Nefesh should override all the prohibitions in the Torah, so we know the Talmud tells us that there are three prohibitions that Pikuach Nefesh does not override. So Pikuach Nefesh does not overcome the prohibition of murder. So if somebody says to me, I'm going to kill you unless you kill that other person, so I don't have a right to kill an innocent person in order to save my life. I have to say, I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to do that. This is one of the three prohibitions that does not override, not overridden by Pikuach Nefesh. So the major issue that is relevant to these types of organ transplants is the question of, if I'm going to take a heart from somebody, let's say we're talking about a heart transplant, so that's perhaps the most prominent example. So if you're going to take a heart from somebody, so in order to do that, so I have to assume that the person is deceased, because the person is not going to be able to consider, because they're not going to be able to continue living after his heart is taken. So if he's not deceased, so then taking the heart is going to certainly kill the person. So I'm not allowed to kill somebody in order to save my own life, so I can't take somebody's heart out in order to save their life. So in order for me to be able to take their heart, I have to assume that the person is considered to be deceased. Now, if we work with the most expansive definition of them being deceased, so that would require the heart to have stopped beating already. And if the heart is no longer beating, so then it's not viable for a heart transplant. In order for the transplant to work, it's got to be that the heart is still beating, and that's necessary in order for this to take place. So this puts us into a very narrow window, that we have to believe the individual is dead, even though their heart is still beating. And this is the central question, the question of the definition of death. And the definition of death is a very, very complicated discussion, which we are going to vastly oversimplify for the purposes of just sketching out some of the territory here. But to speak really too simply, there are, let's say, two major indicators that we're looking at. So on the one hand, there is respiration, there is breathing, which is going to be regulated by the brain. So in theory, a person can be brain dead, and his heart can still be beating. There can still be circulation going on. So I would need to believe that that's called death in order to allow for a heart transplant to take place. If I go for a second standard beyond that, that the circulation has to stop also, that the heart has to be stopped, so then that's going to be a problem. That's not going to allow the transplant to take place. So what is the definition of death? So that's a very unclear question. And it's not something that we have a very obvious, very direct source from the Torah or from the Talmud. And therefore, it's the subject of tremendous machlokas. And unfortunately, because of some of the nuances of the discussion, so it's possible to read just about every source that we have, the handful of sources that we have, it's possible to read every source in whichever direction you think it should be tilting. So there's enough ambiguity in all the sources that we have that allows the possibility of interpreting them in both directions, because for many years this was not really the most crucial issue, because it's only in recent generations that it's possible to separate the two. Normally, if the brain would stop functioning, so the heart would stop functioning very soon afterwards, and if it was at all perceptible when the difference was, it would be negligible. But nowadays, because of medical technology, and it's possible to keep people going on a respirator, so it's possible to have a tremendous gap between the time that the brain stops to function and the heart stops to function. And the issue of figuring out when that time period is over has tremendous, tremendous ramifications for many other areas of life and halacha. The question of pulling the plug, the question of are you considering, is it considered ending somebody's life in the middle after the brain has stopped to function? So of course that is a massively painful and sensitive issue on both ends of the equation, with a tremendous, tremendous emotional, financial, physical, and all other types of ramifications on both sides of the equation. Are you ending your life too soon, or are you unnecessarily prolonging what's already something that's already over? It's a very, very difficult issue. So without this issue, it's already a problem. It's already a difficult enough question. But here, this is another major area which is going to make a big difference to try to figure out which one it is. So the Talmud talks about the Gemara Masechet Yoma, which is perhaps the dominant source that is quoted, but here it's also very vague. And the Gemara talks about a situation where somebody was in a building and the building collapsed. So we're worried that the person is trapped under a building and happens to be Shabbos. So it would involve violating the Shabbos to dig the person out of the building. So if the person is still alive and we can take them out of the building and save their life, so then Pikuach Nefesh is going to override Shabbos. But if the person is no longer alive, then it's a question of burial, so then that's not going to have the same type of impact. So the Gemara says you have to try to ascertain. The person is covered up partially by this building, and you have to try to ascertain, are they alive or not? So how are you going to ascertain? So the Gemara has discussions. Did you try to uncover from the rubble? Until then, it depends also where you're coming from the top of the body or the bottom of the body, but you have to try to get to the nose, or should you try to go to the heartbeat? So on the one hand, you could say, okay, here are two indications. So the heart will tell me if the heart's still beating, and the nose will tell me if there's still breathing going on. So maybe the issue, whether it's the heartbeat or whether it's the nose, is about whether it's breathing or whether it's the heartbeat, whether it's respiration or whether it's circulation. However, that's not even so clear that that's the issue. It could be that maybe the issue really is breathing, but that maybe you can't always tell if a person is breathing or not. So then maybe we need to listen to the heartbeat to see for sure that even though we can't tell if it's breathing, that will tell us for sure that there's nothing going on, that there isn't any life anymore. So whatever standard it is, so there is a terminology that we find in many halachic discussions. Sometimes if we're told that we want to look for a certain sign, so the later Sfarim discuss, is that called a shiba or is that called a simen? Meaning, is this the reason something is true, or is this the indication that something is true? So if I'm going to say that I have to check for the heartbeat to see if the person is still alive, is that because the heartbeat is the definition of life? Or is it because, no, the heartbeat is not a definition of life, maybe breathing is a definition of life, but maybe the heartbeat is an indication that there's breathing that I can't perceive? So that's where there's ambiguity, and that's where there's a lot of discussion as to what exactly is the standard. Is the standard respiration, or is the standard circulation, or is the standard perhaps even somewhere in between? So that's a very unclear issue, and you have Poskim really taking both sides of the equation. And there are a few other sources also. The Chasam Sofer is the author of one of the very famous tshuvas about this in the other day, and it's in Ayin Vav. And he was discussing, he's also living in a pre-organ transplant era, he was discussing this for the purposes of burial. Because in France they wanted to pass a law that you should have to wait a certain period of time before burying people, because who knows, maybe they're just unconscious, maybe they're just drunk, maybe they're not moving and you don't know, maybe they're going to wake up. And apparently that was a problem, people were being buried while they were still alive. Edgar Allan Poe was terrified about this, he wrote stories about this. He wanted in his will that they should put a bell in his grave, because he was terrified that he would wake up in a coffin and he would still be alive, and they should put a bell so he should be able to tell people that he's still alive. So that's what they were worried about in France. They wanted to pass the law, I think, that you should have to wait 3 days before burying somebody so you shouldn't have any question that they're not alive anymore. And of course that also is a problem, because we believe in a speedy burial, ideally on the same day, so we didn't want to necessarily do that either. So the Chasam Sofer has this tshuva where he discusses that what exactly are the indications of death. And there he talks about not breathing or having a heartbeat and not moving, which is also important, because in theory a person could have artificial respiration and artificial heartbeat and be alive because you should be moving around. So you have to have all these three things in place in order to have an indication that a person is deceased. Again, the question is Franz Wolfer talking about any one of these as the absolute indication of death, or is this, again, just reflective of a reality that might be there without all of these things? So a lot of the literature essentially is ambiguous, and which leads to a lot of the debates that we find later. The Chacham Tzvi, for example, Chacham Tzvi is the father of Jacob Emden, it was in the early 1700s, so the Chacham Tzvi has a tshuva where he seems to say that everything is about the heart. But if you look at the tshuva, so it's clear that he understood the heart to be a respiratory organ. So he really understood it to be about breathing. So it's, again, another source that is somewhat ambiguous. It's interesting, there's a minority, there's a contemporary Dayan in Brooklyn, his name is Rabbi Zilber, has authored the tshuvas, Mosne Tzedek. So he wrote a tshuva, which is not at all a conventional opinion, where he believes that everything is about breathing. So if everything's about breathing, so that's the law for transplants, because then when a person stops breathing on his own, so then the heart could still be functioning. So he explains that, no, it's all about breathing, but he counts artificial breathing, that even breathing on a respirator is also going to be considered to be breathing, which is a very hard to understand opinion, because in theory a person who is completely deceased could be hooked up to a respirator and it's not going to make him alive again. So presumably what he means is that when the respirator extends natural breathing, a person is already breathing and the respirator then keeps it going, so then that's perpetuating life as long as that's going on, but that's not necessarily, that's not such a common opinion. So again, to vastly oversimplify it, so it essentially seems to boil down to this question, is it really about breathing or is it about circulation? Some of the poskim felt, many of the poskim felt, that perhaps we don't really have any source that definitively tells us one way or another, and therefore that leaves us in a position of safek reticha, that leaves us in a position where we may possibly be killing the person who we're taking the organ from. And if the situation is safek, so then we're left with no choice but to be stringent, that we have to assume that if we may possibly be committing an act of murder, so then that would certainly be a situation where a safek, where an unclear situation is going to indicate the stringency, and that's going to leave us unable to actively do anything that will bring about this person's death. That's the position that Rabbi Schechter takes. Rabbi Schechter has noted there's a number of indications that maybe blood is the source of life, in addition to the pasuk Yadam Hu HaNefesh, but there are other halachic indications. The Gemara says that Chavallah, if you wound somebody on Shabbos, they draw blood, so drawing blood is considered to be an act related to shechita. It's considered to be an act related to killing somebody. The idea that removing their blood has the partial act of taking away their life. There are halachic indications that circulation is really the main indication, and there are other indications again that take us in a different direction. So therefore, maybe we're left in a situation which is essentially a suffix. That's the position that Rabbi Schechter maintained. And as we'll discuss if we have more time, so many poskim, actually almost already out of time, many poskim are very, very unclear about this, But Rav Soloveitchik's opinion has been hotly debated by many of his students and many of his descendants, but a number of his descendants have maintained that he also felt this way, that this is essentially a suffix that we are not in a position to clarify, that we don't have the information to clarify. I think one of his descendants quoted him as saying that even the Vilna Gaon would not have been able to paskin this issue. We simply don't have enough to go on. And therefore, that would leave us in a position not able to act under the assumption that there might be an act of achievement here. On the other hand, hi. Well, that's working off that assumption. So that's also just to get to that point. So there's also the view of Rav Shlomo Zalman. Rav Shlomo Zalman was very strong in his position that brain death is not death. And there's lots of stuff about it, and since we're essentially already almost out of time, so we'll have to go very quickly through this, but he actually felt that in theory brain death could be death if he was convinced that every single brain cell was totally dead, that was generally not the case. So what is termed the brain death, this is also, as we know, and if we had more time, we could go into it more, the phrase brain death could mean, as you know, a number of different things along the spectrum, and therefore there's some ambiguity just in terms of the terminology, and just in terms of what situation we're talking about, which also leaves room for different situations to have different statuses. So it's a longer discussion than we actually have time for right now, but that's also a possibility. So there were those who view this whole situation as a suffix, and there were those who view the situation and not as a suffix. Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Soloveitchik and others were very convinced that it's absolutely not death, that this is not considered to be death at all, and therefore to take an organ from a person who is brain dead would, in their perception, be an act of killing that person and would be completely forbidden. On the other hand, there were those who felt that it is death. This is the view that Rabbi Talmud advocates. And Rabbi Talmud's understanding, brain death is equal to absolute decapitation. It's very clear from the Gemara, if a person's head is cut off, so they're not considered to be alive. And even if there's movement afterwards, even if there's things taking place in the body, that doesn't necessarily negate that fact. And we know that there is electrical activity that can take place. The chicken is a famous example, but there's electrical activity that can take place in a living being even after the head is cut off. So that was Rabbi Talmud's understanding that brain death is equivalent to complete decapitation, complete separation of the brain controls from the rest of the body. And therefore, even if there's movement afterwards, that's not considered to be living. Even if the heart is beating, that's not considered to be life. And that is why his position is that organ transplants are permissible, because that's his perspective on that situation. So essentially, that's a little bit of the debate. The rabbinical, the chief rabbinate of Eretz Yisrael has taken that position as well. Our position is similar to Rabbi Talmud, that brain death can be considered death, again, with a lot of nuances in between, and therefore allowing for transplant. All of that still would leave a couple of other issues, just to very quickly identify what some of them might be in our remaining 2 minutes. So one issue is that there is also a minority view that even if you believe that brain death is not death, so maybe it's still not necessarily true that Yehar V'Yavor applies, that the idea that you can't kill somebody else to save your own life. So most posts can assume that means whoever that person is, even if that person is what we might call a trace, if a person is in a situation where he's certainly on the path to death and he's irrevocably heading in that direction, nothing can be done to save him. So most posts can assume that that status is no different than anybody else. And it's still Yehari Valyavor to kill that person to save your own life. But there is a minority view, some suggested, Rintaman was one of them, a few others also felt, that the Talmud says, I can't kill somebody else to save my own life. The Talmud says, because who says my blood is better than his? I can't assume that my life is worth more than his. But if the person is what's known as a treif, a person is irrevocably on the path towards death, so there is a halachic distinction. You're not allowed to kill a person who's a treifa, but there is no punishment of misa. There's no death penalty associated with killing a treifa. So some wanted to suggest that maybe you should say that that is a valid trade-off to make, that a person can kill a treifa, so to speak, in order to save the life of somebody who has potential to have a longer life. That's a highly controversial view, but again, there is a minority view among a number of poskim who want to take this position. Maybe some proof from the comment of the Me'iri and Sanhedrin. Others point out that the Me'iri and the Dharm says differently. So that's one of the debates. Another debate is then, even if you assume that organ transplants are going to be permitted, so is it appropriate to sign a donor card, to sign a driver's license, for example, which is going to be very vaguely applied. So that a lot of the postkin felt there were many more concerns to be taken into consideration, even on top of the basic issue of organ transplants itself, which opens up a whole other discussion that even whatever conclusions you may come to as far as the basic issues, are they being applied consistently in hospitals today, is a very open issue in and of itself. And one last issue, which is also extremely complicated and extremely sensitive, is the question is if one assumes that one's not allowed to donate organs, so does that necessarily mean that one is not allowed to receive organs? And that's a very tricky issue. If there's a straight moral equation, it sounds very bad to say I can't give but I can receive. And there's no question that that's something that's very hard to accept. And understandably, many people find that very difficult to say. On the other hand, it depends a little bit on how you look at it. If you believe that the issue is that I'm killing somebody else, that's why I can't, or I'm killing this person, why I can't take his organs, so then if the reality is, and this reality is also debatable, but if the reality is that this is going to happen anyway, so it's just a question of whether this, you take the organs or whether somebody else takes the organs, so then it's not necessarily the same thing as killing the person to begin with in order to take the organs. And this would be especially true if you believe that you're not sure that it's murder, but it's a suspect murder, so then you could all the more so understand why you're not going to perform this action because you're not sure that it's not murder. But if it's taking place already, and you believe also it's possible it's not murder, so it would not necessarily extend to say that you wouldn't benefit from it. So as difficult as that is to relate to morally, depending on how you look at it, there's two sides to that equation as well. And I guess luckily we're all just about out of time. Hi.
So the advertisements for the organ transplant that